And welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Buer.
And I'm GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns. And we welcome you guys back to, I think, our first episode here in at least three weeks.
It's something embarrassing because, you know, the holidays and bowl game and,
I know people care, but
I think
this month, in terms of December, I think I've slept in my own bed 8 days out of 31 between various activities going on. So it's been pretty hectic, and obviously Luke and I talked about potentially doing a preview episode, but between our two schedules in terms of this game being right around Christmas, it just wasn't going to work out. And obviously there's been a lot that's happened, I think, since the last time Luke and I recorded, so we do have some things to get into other than a Holiday Bowl victory. But joining us, as always, is former Golden Gopher offensive lineman and my second cousin, Mr. Derek Burns. Derek, how were the holidays for you, and how are you on New Year's Eve here?
I'm doing well, guys. Thanks for having me back. It's a fun time of year for college football. You know, get to talk about the Gophers bowl game, and we've got a lot in the midst of many other big games here. So it's excited to be back with you.
I also think this is the first time we've recorded like before noon ever. So this is going to be a first. I don't know. Ryan is a young millennial. He looks really, really tired. He came to my house this time, and this might be a doozy. So if you think he's incoherent and not making sense, blame it on the morning sunshine.
If the energy in my voice sounds lacking, it's because it is before 9:45 in the morning on a Saturday. And I can tell you from, I don't know if anybody here is listening to this that was out in San Diego, and if you were, you knew there were a lot of late nights out there. And so
yeah,
trying to still catch up on sleep, but little lack of energy here this morning, but we'll get through it. We'll start by talking about this Holiday Bowl game, Luke.
Yeah, let's get into that. So the Gophers came into this game a large underdog, a 10-point underdog, I think, was the final line before kickoff, and quite frankly, this was utter domination by the Gopher defense. They come away with a 17-12 victory. They hold arguably, you know, the best, well, actually statistically the second best passing offense in all of FBS to under 200 yards. They kept everything in front of them. Luke Falk, arguably one of the top quarterback prospects. Maybe he comes out this year, likely not, probably stays another year, and he'll be a top NFL draft prospect just for the mental side of the game and how he handles that. He was held to no touchdowns before garbage time. I mean, this was just a stunning performance by the Gopher defense. And Derek, I don't know if you want to give a, you know, we typically talk, you know, good things and bad things, but from things that impressed you from this game, what really stood out?
Well, I think a lot of people there's been a lot of talk about the game plan on defense, which was excellent. Don't want to take anything away from that. I mean, on the first series alone, or the first drive alone for Washington State, Minnesota had at least four different looks, you know, two down linemen, 4-2-5, 3-2-6, even went with a dime package of six DBs, 4-3-4. So clearly they wanted to mix things up, keep Washington State off guard. But I think the part that really impressed me, in addition to a nice game plan, was just the execution from the pass, you know, pass defense. So mainly Minnesota played man-to-man on the outside with their defensive backs, their corners and their safeties. They did an excellent job. They kept it in press a lot, so they kept things in front of them. And then underneath, with the linebackers dropping many times, you know, four of those linebackers in the coverage into a zone, really kept things in check on the underneath routes. And just ultimately, the plays on the ball, I mean, after the ball was thrown, was just, it was as good as they've done all year, and maybe in many years. And that's both with the secondary and the linebackers. I mean, call out a couple of guys, Coney Durr, you know, the way he reacted to passes and breaks on the ball was really remarkable, considering his youth and the amount of playing time he's had. Usually as a defensive back, you know, guys come in with a lot of talent, or what talent level they have, and speed. And one of the last things they learn is how to break on the ball and make plays on the ball. And that's usually something that can be learned. And clearly he either has that instinctually, or he's picked that up quickly, because he was able to make plays on the ball, as was the rest of the defense. So I would just say, you know, in addition to an incredible game plan on defense, the execution, you know, especially post pass, was as good as I've seen.
I was just saying to Luke, you are taking every point I was thinking of in real time. I think you made a lot of good points. I think that the game plan from Jay Saville coming into this game, and then in terms of how his players executed it, I don't think you could do a better job of doing that. And I think the remarkable thing is they're able to hold Luke Falk in this air raid offense, an offense that was averaging 370 passing yards a game, over three passing touchdowns a game, and they're able to hold them going into that final drive of garbage time under 200 yards passing and no passing touchdowns. And all that being said, they're doing it with five of their seven top defensive backs out. Because coming into the game, you had four of your top six out with, I'm sure I'm going to forget one here, Buford, Chanot, Harden, and Antoine Winfield out. Mm-hmm. And then Coney Durr goes out with a knee injury in the second half, so you're forced to put in Zoe Creighton, who's played about 15 snaps all season. And again, you're able to stymie this entire passing offense for the basically the entire game. And again, if you weren't a Jay Saville fan before this in terms of his game plan and his execution of it in terms of his players, I mean, you saw guys like Jacob Huff see a lot of snaps. You saw Zoe Creighton get a lot of snaps. You saw a lot of, there were instances of, I believe, 1-4-6, if I'm doing my math correctly in my head, with 11 guys in the field. Obviously, there was a lot of 2-4-5 as well, but I mean, just making sure that everything was going to be in front of them. You know, from talking with some people, that was going to be the game plan, was do not get beat deep. Make Luke Falk and this passing offense dink and dunk their way down the field, because it's so hard to sustain drives that way. I mean, you saw them do it on their first possession, 17-play drive that ends in a field goal, but the remainder of the drives, I think 8 of the next 10 drives were either a punt or and I think the next one was a turnover. So again, they were able to get pressure as well with only 3 or 4 guys. Again, some of that was after 4, 5, 6 seconds because Minnesota's dropping 8 into coverage, and you know, he's got nothing to look at down the field because Minnesota's able to try and do some things there. But I just think that the game plan by Jay Saville, he did something that an entire Pac-12, 12 games for teams going against Washington State that they weren't able to do. And again, I understand that Minnesota is a different breed in terms of the quality of Pac-12 offenses that Washington State goes against, or even in the non-conference, but for Minnesota to be able to execute that game plan as well as they did, down the amount of bodies that they were, and I mean, even Duke McGee gets ejected, so you could say, you know, for a period of time, 6 of their top 8 defensive backs are out, and Minnesota still able to do what they were able to do. I just think that the execution, and I think Demaryius said it well after in the post-bowl press conference, was they had their best week of practice. They were extremely focused. Every guy on the in the back seven knew what their role was going to be if they were going to be able to shut down Washington State. They came in ready for it. They executed it at a high level, and you see that in Minnesota being able to get that victory.
Well, this is something I found interesting. I watch a decent amount of Pac-12 football just because my mom is an alum from the University of Washington. By the way, go Dogs today. Everybody on Earth should be cheering for them. But stylistically, you know, the Big Ten, for the large part, and the Pac-12 are totally different. Part of the defensive scheme in the Pac-12 is just outscore your own opponent, right? That you're just keeping, you know, the other team chasing you. And this stylistically was totally different. This was the lowest scoring game by far that Washington State was a part of. And it just speaks to the dominance on defense that they were able to have. Additionally, I think something that might be overlooked is just how athletic these linebackers were and how important that was on the underneath stuff. In particular, like Cashman making that play to run up and sack Falk. I thought Carter Coughlin played pretty well. The athleticism there is really important to be able to play the kind of defense that they wanted to play.
I think that was Carter Coughlin's best game overall in terms of being there in run support, in terms of being able to get after the passer. I think that Eden Prairie connection between him and Blake Cashman for the next 2 years, as Blake is going to be a junior next year, is going to be special to watch. And as you mentioned, I think where the turning point for Jay Saville in this defense was when they figured out how to use Blake Cashman. because you saw that in the last six games of the season, the last five games of the season. I tweeted it out after the game that night, but Blake Cashman's final five games of the season, I don't have the tweet in front of me right now, but it's something ridiculous in terms of, I think it was 9.5 tackles for loss and 6 sacks in his final five games. And for a kid that wasn't even playing, it is frankly remarkable in terms of what he's been able to do. And I think some of that is because obviously he's a very talented kid, but it's also that Jay Sovel has figured out how to use him in this 3-4, this 2-4-5 scheme in terms of he needs a very adequate blitzing linebacker, someone that plays with a lot of leverage, someone that plays with a lot of speed, someone that plays with a lot of energy. And when you look at what Minnesota's linebackers were doing for those first 6 or 7 games in terms of being able to generate pressure with different stunts and different blitzes, they weren't exactly getting it done. And then you saw Blake being able to do some things against Maryland in the fourth quarter where he was able to generate pressures. And obviously Jay Sovel saw it on game film, was able to integrate him more into the game plan in the following weeks. And each successive week, he's able to continue to play at a high level on defense. And obviously, I don't know that we've seen as special of a special teams player in terms of Blake Cashman in quite some time, because it literally is. If you go back and watch this entire season, especially in the last few games, if there is a punt or a kickoff, I swear to God, every time the guy making the tackle is Blake Cashman. And you think that opposing special teams coordinators would figure that out and double team him, but it seems like he's either eluding that or he's just, I mean, he's a tremendously talented player on special teams, and he's been able to generate a lot of things in this linebacking core specifically. I mean, you look at the guys that were making an impact against Washington State, Kamal Martin, Carter Coughlin, Jalen Waters was out there quite a bit. Blake Cashman was out there, Julian Huff.
Celestine.
And what do they all have in common?
They're all young.
They're all going to be back next season.
Yeah.
So I think that there is a lot of positivity to take from that, knowing that the only guy that you really do lose from that linebacker, or the two guys you lose from that linebacking core, are Nick Rallis and Jack Lynn. But that being said, you have a lot of young talent that it has been performing pretty well throughout this entire season. Derek, what do you think?
Well, yeah, speaking to Cashman specifically, his closing speed, which I think is what you guys
missile.
Are.
When he had that sack, I remember watching him that entire play from the press box. He took a direct line to where it's not where Luke Falk was. It was where he was going to be. And his just ability to go from 0 to 60 and know the angle he has to take to close is absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, for those that have been watching Gopher football for a while, there's some reminiscences of Tyrone Carter, who played strong safety and what ended up being a Thorpe Award winner, best defensive back in college football.
That's quite the high
All-American.
That's quite the high praise.
He in that aspect, though, you know, really the closing speed and the tackling ability in open field there's flashes of that. I think I don't want to set expectations maybe where they shouldn't be. We'll see. I mean, you know, he's a couple years into his career, but that's what it reminds me of in the open field. And so to your point, Ryan, I think what they've done a good job of, and they have to continue to do, is keep him in the open field, whether that's blitzing or spying or dropping into a shallow zone. He's able to close on some of those passes, you know, either for a pass breakup or after a catch on a safety valve, and make an open field tackle is really important. You know, Tracy Clays has talked about a number of times, you know, against spread teams, the key is open field tackling. And so if you can have a guy like that and keep him in space, much like you'd take a running back on offense and try to get plays to get him in space, it's almost the same thing on defense. You don't really want him playing in a phone booth. You know, you don't want him playing downhill in the middle of, you know, the middle of a scrum, so to speak. That's not going to be his strength, but they've found a way to keep him in the open field. And I know they'll come up with more schemes to do that, and he's just continues to get better. So and yes, for the linebacker group, you know, overall, these young guys, it's been, we've seen it on special teams, and it's been fun to watch them grow and continue to get better than on the normal scrimmage plays and show up more and more.
I think that speaks to what Clays was emphasizing a lot in the non-conference. They were going to try and find a way to put players in a position where they could succeed, right? They weren't going to try to get players to basically match the scheme. They were going to have the scheme match the players, right?
Yep.
And that, I think defensively, we saw that executed really well as the season evolved. And it kind of came to the culmination of the Washington State game where that it just epitomized what that defense had become. But conversely, the offense, it, you know, we talked about this quite extensively. You know, they had their strength was running the ball, though, especially from the skill player perspective. And in this game, it kind of epitomized the offense as a whole. Like they were able to execute with a few opportunities. They're able to find a way to get in, and sometimes that might be lucky. But they in no way were dominant, and really kind of lack just the fortitude, or it really just an identity that's in any sort of dominant way.
Well, to speak to your final point about the learning curve on the defensive side of the ball, I think you obviously saw it there in terms of Jay Saville in his first year as defensive coordinator. Tracy really gave him the reins to do what he wanted to do. And so in terms of fitting the players in terms of what you want to do, I think you saw the learning curve there in terms of him putting out a bunch of different packages, him a bunch of people in different spots trying to figure out what people do well. And so that took 6 or 7 games. And then you saw him really start to figure it out towards the latter half of the season. You saw guys really start to get comfortable in their roles, considering Minnesota did play a multitude of different defenses. You saw the 2-4-5, you saw the 3-4, you saw the 4-3, you saw the 4-2-5. Mm-hmm. I mean, you saw a bunch of different things, and that's a lot to throw at an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid who's also got to be a student athlete as well. So you saw the players get more comfortable. You saw Jay Saville get more comfortable in terms of what he wants to do with different personnel groups. How does he utilize the best players to put them in the best spot for his defense? So there was a learning curve there, and I think that you saw the evolution come about a little bit faster than I would imagine. Again, mm-hmm. 6 games into your reign as defensive coordinator, and you actually do start to figure out that. I mean, we've seen a lot of defensive coordinators here at Minnesota not figure it out, and I think that the amount of talent they have is starting to be utilized on that defensive side of the ball. But I think Luke put it as best you could. This offense basically played what the summation of the 2016 season for Minnesota was on offense. In terms of the running game, the offensive line couldn't get a lot of push. Rodney Smith and Shannon Brooks had to create a lot for themselves. There were a few glimpses or a few flashes here and there where, you know, Shannon would have a big hole. He'd get 8-9 yard gains. Rodney Smith would have a hole from time to time, but it'd be a lot of these guys having to create for themselves, turn a 3-yard loss into a 3-yard gain, which, again, doesn't look like a lot on the stat sheet. But, I mean, it means a lot in terms of the game flow propositions. And then we got the news just before kickoff that Tyler Moore wasn't going to be able to play. He had a back injury. Vincent Calhoun didn't play. He has that turf toe, which is going to have he's going to have surgery on here pretty soon. So you look at Matt Leidner, the Leidner to Leidner hashtag narrative was absolutely gigantic. The Leidner brothers being able to go out on top. Matt's going to graduate after this semester. He's already has his degree. So it's something to where, from watching the game back, I was not tremendously impressed with the offensive line. I think Donnell Green struggled. But Derek, the first question I want to tee up for you is on these pre-snap penalties again. I think Minnesota ended up 6 or 7 pre-snap penalties. And what I particularly noticed on film was watching the Washington State Mike linebacker. It was obvious that they'd watch the film, and once Leidner would throw someone into motion, he'd see them right, it'd be about a half second to a second before Leidner was going to call for the ball. He would yell something, Minnesota would jump, and the Washington State offense or defensive line would shift. Now, you being a former offensive lineman at the collegiate level, at the Big Ten level, what did you think of the offensive line's performance, and what did you think of what Washington State was doing in Minnesota's pre-snap penalties?
Well, right, what you're referring to is something that we talked about earlier in the year, and it doesn't generally get called. It wasn't called in the game on the Holiday Bowl, and it is to mimic the snap count from a defensive player is a penalty. It's a delay of game penalty, and it's usually on the umpire to make that call because they're the closest and the best position to do it. But it's usually not called. Sometimes there's they'll give players or coaches a warning if they feel like it's happening. Sometimes they have to bring it up on offense to the officials or the coaches to make them aware of it. But I do think that played a little bit of a factor, but as we've talked about, if they're not calling it, you have to find a way to to get around that and not jump off sides, not have the pre-snap penalties. I mean, I don't know, just off the top of my head, I don't know of any game I can think of where a team with six false starts wins the game. So it's they're fortunate in that aspect that, you know, having that many penalties set them back, that they were still able to overcome it. So, but, you know, in general, we're talking about the 13th game of the season. This still seems to be an issue. Perhaps they go back in the off season now and really just go with a completely different cadence system. I think if you don't have it figured out by the end of the year, perhaps that's, especially with most of that offensive unit coming back next year, maybe you've got to go a different direction on the cadence and go to something else. So it'd be interesting to see if they do that. You know, in general, I thought the offensive line, I guess I would mirror your comments, Ryan. They struggled to get a consistent push. I don't know. They didn't appear that they had a lot of missed assignments. I don't think Washington State was blitzing a lot, much like we've seen from opponents all year. Sometimes they went plus one in the box, and sometimes they matched up, but then they brought a safety post-snap. And many of those times, that extra defender is making the tackle for, you know, a 1 yard gain or a 2 yard gain. And it's difficult if you can't throw out of that, or if you can't get a big push to turn those into, you know, 5 and 6 yard gains, you're going to end up with a low production on offense. The one thing I did want to point out that I was pleased with is we've talked about, it didn't really show up on the scoreboard, but we've talked about all year trying to manufacture big plays. And yeah, it was nice to see them take a flea flicker, a reverse, a wheel route, which they ended up scoring on, fortunately.
They tried to do a halfback pass as well.
Yeah, halfback pass. They took at least three deep shots, independent of those plays we just mentioned.
One of these years, we will complete a deep shot. I'm just holding out hope that one of these years, Minnesota is going to actually complete a higher clip than 20% of their deep shots. But go on, Derek.
Yep. Well, it was, I was glad that they took the shots. I think that going into the game, they probably felt on offense that they needed to come up with a lot of points. Now, ironically, that wasn't the case because of how well the defense played, but it was nice to see them take those shots. And I just wanted to point out, if you look at those plays, none of those plays ended up being a turnover. None of those plays resulted in a penalty against the offense. So, you know, the conventional wisdom, you know, tends to say, well, you can't take these big risky plays because you're going to end up, you know, throwing an interception or something like that. You know, with all those plays, the halfback pass, the flea flicker, the reverse, the wheel route, none of those ended up in an interception or a big, you know, penalty on offense. So it didn't hurt them. Now, they ended up converting on one of them on the wheel route. You know, it was a tip ball from the safety, and they were fortunate to come up with it. Incidentally, the running back was held twice on that play on his route and didn't get called. But if they, you know, it's always a game of what could have been. But if they convert on say two more of those six or seven big plays, now we're talking about, you know, we're talking about them scoring in the 30s perhaps or upper 20s. So I like that they took the shots, I guess, from the game plan perspective. But execution wise, I think they needed some more consistency and a little bit more push up front. And I think they could have controlled the game a bit more.
Yeah, I agree with you. I said the same thing actually watching the game. Like, I appreciate that they're taking these shots. And it's kind of what we clamored for all season. And they recognize, especially against a high powered offense like Washington State, you might have to, you know, show your hand and try and manufacture those plays. So I appreciated that. The other thing that I think maybe got overlooked a little bit in this game was just how effective they were in the special teams. I thought Ryan Santoso arguably had his best game. He was able to flip the field a couple times. He had 7 punts, 4 inside the 20. You know, his average was right around 44 yards per kick. I mean, he had a really nice game. Additionally, you know, Carpenter got a lucky bounce, got the field goal to bank in, but they were really, really good on special teams. And Ryan has informed me that, you know, he basically called this in his game preview, which
yeah,
I didn't
if you
read.
Read the game preview on Gopher Illustrated, you knew the huge battle that Minnesota had to win was on special teams, because Washington State is a bottom 10 special teams unit and Minnesota is a top 10 special teams unit in the season. So that was an area Minnesota had to win. And I think Ryan had his most consistent game of the year, because that was the game I was expecting him to have. you know, 9 or 10 of 13 games throughout the season. And obviously that didn't come, you know, it didn't come to fruition. But, I mean, that's what you see that Ryan Santoso can be. I mean, someone that can put it inside the 20, a couple punts over 50 yards. His net punt average is over 40 yards, so I'd say that's pretty decent. And I just think that special teams as a whole, because you saw on punt and kickoff coverage, I mean, we talked about it a little bit earlier. If there's a punt or if there's a kickoff, I am 100% expecting Blake Cashman to make the tackle and make it in a timely fashion, which happened more times than not. So Minnesota was able to take advantage of that on special teams, and you know that was one of the areas. And even Rodney Smith being able to do some things in terms of the kickoff return game. So, again, that's where Minnesota has really taken the edge, where if their offense isn't doing a lot and their defense is doing what they can, that's where the special teams unit can come and flip the field, per se, in terms of either putting the opponent within their own 20 or the punt return or the kickoff return, putting Minnesota's offense in advantageous situations.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think I'll kind of open the floor to you guys if you have any comments, Derek, first. If there's anything else you wanted to touch on, and then we can kind of transition to kind of the big elephant in the room, which is the where does the football program go from here over the next handful of days?
Well, just maybe one more thing on the game that just, I think it's probably at the front of everybody's mind. Maybe it's stating the obvious, but another great game from the running backs. The Gophers, you know, just being able to yards after contact from both Rodney Smith and Shannon Brooks was outstanding. It's something we've seen all year. And I guess maybe just mentioning it so we don't get too spoiled or don't forget about it. But that was, especially at the end of the game, the drive to sort of seal the game and hold on to the ball and, you know, and maintain possession and end up scoring was huge. And I think I put a lot of that on the running backs.
Yeah, Rodney Smith and Shannon Brooks are just tremendously talented running backs. And again, go back and watch the Washington State game if you have some free time over the holidays, and watch Rodney Smith in pass pro, because he is absolutely fantastic, and he gives Leidner time more than a few times. So, I mean, seeing a running back that's ends up with, I think, 1,182 rushing yards, 16 rushing touchdowns, and he's not afraid to stick his nose in the face of a Mike linebacker and punch him in the mouth and help his quarterback out in pass protection is very neat to see. I think you got to see Shannon relax a little bit more, because I think he was pressing for the last half of the season in terms of trying to make things what they were not and seeing things that they weren't there, trying to hit that home run. And I think you saw him calm down a little bit more. But finally, before we get into the coaching discussion, I do want to talk about the seniors, because this year's senior class won 31 games. They won 8 in 2013, 8 in 2014, 6 in 2015, and then 9 this season, which is the most since 2005, when that class won 32 games. And prior to that 2005 class, the last senior class to win 30 games at the University of Minnesota was in 1905. And that was a group that won 46 games. So I think that this group of seniors, you know, Mitch Leidner, Jack Lynn, Jonah Perzig, I mean, the list goes on. They did a lot of things in terms of building that foundation that Jerry Kill came in and talked about, you know, brick by brick, trying to lead this foundation, you know, better than what they found it. And I think that they did so. 31 games, it's somewhere 7.75, Mr. Engineering major next to me, I think. I mean, that's something that just doesn't happen a lot consistently at Minnesota. And so I think that if you do have a chance, you know, sometime over the holiday season here, or if you see any of these guys in person, first thing I would recommend doing is, you know, if you didn't get a chance to do it in San Diego, I mean, most of these guys have social media, and if you want to, you know, shoot a tweet their way thanking them for their time here, because I think that they did do a lot. I think that each and every one of them would appreciate that. You know, they just have done so much for setting an example of winning here. And, you know, forever, you know, there's been a lot of bad things said about this university and this football team in the last month. Again, don't let a few bad apples spoil the bunch, because I don't think there's a cultural problem around this football team. I mean, they've done so well in academics. They've done so well in other areas that I think that there is good leadership on this football team. It's just a few made bad choices. And again, I don't want them to ruin it for the rest of this football team. So if you do get a chance here in the next, you know, few days, you know, pick out a few of your favorite players and, you know, wish them the best on social media, on the Twitter machine or maybe Facebook. Just tell them thank you for the time, because, again, I know each and every one of them would appreciate it. But Luke, let's get into it. I mean, there is the elephant in the room. Yeah. Next time, I'm guessing we record a podcast, we're going to have resolution because of all the different things I've heard. And
yeah,
but
okay, let's get into it. So let's maybe start with a quick summary of the season. The Gophers end up 9-4 on the season. This is the first time in how many years since they won 9 games? Something absurd.
9 wins is the second most for the Gophers since 1905, yeah, according to a tweet that was released yesterday by the football team. So again, 9 wins at Minnesota is something. Doesn't happen very often.
Now, you know, that's a good thing, but I can understand a fan base that, you know, is still frustrated that they had 4 losses where they, you know, they had an opportunity to beat a Penn State team that's playing in a New Year's Six bowl. You had a Iowa team that you really probably should have beat as well. Same goes with Nebraska and Wisconsin, where you had 4th quarter leads. Wisconsin's another team that's in a New Year's Six bowl. So you say that, and you know there were opportunities that were obviously missed, and that can frustrate fans. The schedule is probably set up to be the best looking schedule that they've had in recent memory, and seemingly they didn't come up with a win against a team they arguably maybe shouldn't have beat, with the lone exception probably being the Washington State game, a team that was ranked in the top 25 for a good portion of the year. But I can see the frustration. Now let's add on top of that, basically the PR nightmare that is the scandal. I don't think we really need to divulge in that. That's very well, that's been very well documented basically in national and local media. I don't think we can add a whole lot more to that, but that puts a lot of pressure on a coaching staff and administration, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess here's the situation. A first year head coach, arguably a first year head coach, has arguably one of the most successful seasons in recent memory. Now associate that with the given scandal and having to, you know, manage 115 players, which is darn near impossible to do. Right. I mean, where do we go from here? Like, there are systemic problems that exist on college campuses with domestic assault. We're not going to sexual assault and domestic assault, right? That we're not going to overshadow that. That this isn't unique to Minnesota. This happens absolutely everywhere, and it's not good, right? We're not trying to condone any of that behavior, but at the same time, you know, where does I don't even know how to say it. Who's going to take the sword, right? Yeah, like, is it going to have to be Tracy Clays? Is he the one that's responsible? Or how is the administration going to handle this? This is the thing. This is why it's such a big elephant in the room, right? Nobody knows. I think there are people, there are polarizing opinions. You're probably on one side or the other, and you probably don't sit in the middle, right? There probably exists very few people that can kind of see both sides. And then the public perception also exists that aren't football fans that think based on the actions of a few that one person should lose their job over it. Right. Even though they probably can't even spell Tracy Clays.
Yeah. That's the whole issue with the petition is how many of those people even know how to spell his last name if they want him gone so badly, or do they just think that this is a sexual assault issue on campuses, which again, we understand here at the Gopher Gridiron Radio podcast that it is a gigantic issue across colleges across the country. But, I mean, I think Luke set it up perfectly is who's going to fall on the sword, because you look at Kaler, you look at Coyle, you look at Clays, how do all three survive this considering what kind of a PR nightmare it has been for this university? And I just think that, you know, it seems like people are on one side or the other in terms of either you think Kaler should go or you think Clays should go, because I think it's pretty evident that Mark Coyle is a puppet for whatever Eric Kaler wants to do. And I don't necessarily think that either one of them are so at fault, because Luke, we were talking about in the pre-production meeting with Derek that, you know, the players are clamoring for due process, but this isn't a University of Minnesota issue in terms of this issue specifically. This is just across college campuses. Going to what you were saying in terms of the pre-production.
So I'm no legal expert by any stretch of the imagination.
You are married to a lawyer, so that kind of does count.
Not really. I mean, this is a lot bigger. This is more policy than anything, but part of the problem that exists right now is that I think it's the affirmative action legislation they passed in 1972, which essentially enabled Title IX. There are laws that allow or basically say that there's student privacy stuff, which, you know, some universities are using to their advantage to hide and not talk about stuff. I don't know the logistics, but that's come under a lot of scrutiny publicly, both in, you know, huge publications. I think Stanford's kind of tried to change their tune on certain stuff. That has just come under scrutiny, that administrations can kind of hide behind it and not have to take a specific stance. I shouldn't really comment much further because I'm by means no expert, but there's an obvious problem that a lot of people point to as being that rule. I'll try and find this as we're talking, but there is actually a really nice write up in the local paper. Derek had mentioned it as well, where they pointed to the issue and I'll look it up and cite it here while we talk about it. But the point being, there's a larger issue in how universities handle these sort of cases and these sort of issues, and making sure that the process is fair. I mean, you can cite, I'm not trying to say what the players did or didn't do is deplorable and wrong from a moral standpoint, in my opinion. But you have cases like the Duke lacrosse, like other things, where people, you know, they rush to a rash decision.
Yeah,
quick to judge maybe is the right way, and that's in the process that exists due to the legislation that or the laws that exist are make it challenging and put a lot of pressure. And the fact that there is a huge sexual assault issue nationally, these universities are under pressure to make a statement and show that they're not going to support this and try to, you know, combat it in some way. And that's where it's complicated. It's super complicated, and I'm not an expert to be able to comment on this. I'm just a lowly engineer.
All right. So, I mean, where I'm at specifically in terms of this entire, you know, again, I talked about the two sides. It seems like people are either on the Clay side, they're either on the Kaler side. Where I'm at is I just think that there is a lack of leadership in terms of the University of Minnesota athletics. But where that has to start is at the top, because I think that Eric Kaler throughout this entire process has done only enough of what's asked of him at the time, and he hasn't taken it to the next step in terms of, you know, this entire deal comes out, 10 players are suspended indefinitely, but it's like they only thought to that specific point and they didn't think of what's going to happen next until they were forced to act until, you know, what's going to be next. And that's a little bit frightening to me. And I think that, I mean, you also have to look at, you know, the leadership in terms of on the Board of Regents. I know that we've talked about, you know, Laura Broad specifically on Gopher Illustrated in terms of someone that has been publicly super against Clay's based off her social media. I mean, she has, again, this is totally going into high school type of things in terms of reading what social media and what people put on it. But she was very vocal on social media about how Clay's is, you know, this bad person, and how that, you know, he's really, you know, why is he supporting sexual assault when he tweeted out his statement? You know, he's supporting his players. And now this team found out about it, and they're asking for her support after they win the Holiday Bowl, and she has yet to offer it. I mean, this is just high school politic kind of things. Like, if your Board of Regents isn't going to support your Gopher football team, you know, regardless of what she feels about, you know, the head coach, I mean, where are we at as an institution? And it's very frightening to me. And again, I say these things about Eric Kaler. I don't think that Tracy Clays is nearly the leader that Jerry Kill was. I don't think that many people are. I think that Kill had a fantastic rap on this program, or in terms of his garnering his players' respect, garnering, you know, their attention in terms of, you're going to do it this way, you're going to obey this way, and you're going to look up to me, and I will lead you. I don't think Tracy is nearly the leader. You know, take that for what it may be. I do think he's a fantastic football coach, but in terms of what a head football coach should entail, I think that leadership is absolutely a large part of that. And because he's going to have a say, you know, players act like their head coach, players act like their quarterback, and you know that they'll rally around their quarterback knowing it's Mitch Leiner, and a lot of guys would run through the wall for him. but I don't know that Tracy Claries is necessarily that guy.
So I referenced an article, and I think it does a good job of summing up, so I'll just put it out there so that people can check it out. But Frank, I think it's Lamonte, wrote an article for the Star Tribune, and it was titled The Youth Football Crisis, Trainwreck of Privacy Laws Made Matters Worse. And it encapsulates a little bit of the basically what I was not able to eloquently say. So if you want to try and get a better understanding of the point I'm trying to make, where the privacy laws basically make things worse on campuses rather than maybe better, and there maybe needs to be change there. Now, again, I just want to reiterate, I'm not trying to condone anything the players did. I'm just trying to say that it's the problems that exist on campuses are a lot larger and more systemic than, you know, making sure a head coach can watch 115 players or whatever that might be. And that we have to find better ways to handle this. And I think this points at some of the issues that certain federal laws are basically handcuffing administrations or giving them outs that maybe aren't really, really fair. And I think it points to some of the due process that I don't think was necessarily well spoken by the point of the boycott or whatever that might be.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's an overall disconnect in this athletic department, from the president to the board of regents, the athletic director to the head coaches, because, you know, I was talking with some people out in San Diego, and if, you know, what even a majority of what I heard was true from some donors and just some other people that I was talking with, if the way that Tracy Claries did find out about this was indeed from someone not in the athletic department, how in the world can that happen? How can the head football coach of someone that is just about to have a PR nightmare, how does he not know that something is going to happen to 10 of his players? And why, you know, how does he not know until the media knows? And how does he not told about this from Eric Kaler or Mark Coyle? How does that happen at a Power 5 institution is absolutely beyond me. And that, it's, again, if I laugh at the people that think that Tracy Claries and Mark Coyle and Eric Kaler have like a legitimate working relationship, I think that Coyle and Claries have, you know, somewhat of a pretty good relationship. But if you think that Kaler and Claries can be in the same room at the same time and have a legitimate talk, I think you are wishful thinking. And again, that shouldn't be the case at a Power 5 institution in terms of the university president and the head football coach. So the lack of communication, the lack of just everybody on the same page at this university is very frightening. And, you know, say Tracy Claries does take the fall for this. Say he is fired early next week. What is going to change with a new head football coach in terms of everything I just described? Mark Coyle is what he is, folks. I mean, he's being paid $850,000 to basically be whatever Eric Kaler wants him to be. And again, if you're fine with that, then that's your prerogative. But I think that Coyle doesn't have a ton of power, I guess, right now. You know, maybe he does in terms of being able to, you know, make a change at the head football coaching position now that he has leverage to do so. In terms of, I think it's been clear since this has come out that, I mean, starting with the, you know, Mark Coyle coming out with a statement saying we, how was it phrased, Luke?
His initial statement before all this happened was he was going to do everything he could to support Tracy Claries.
Well, not even in those, because I think it was evident that they never did say, Mark Coyle never did say extension specifically in that. But in terms of,
he was going to review expectations for the program.
I'm talking about in terms of when this whole entire deal came out, and he said, you know, in correspondence with Tracy, we made this decision.
Oh, yeah. So
I don't remember the specific verbiage or the specific vernacular used there, but it was in some way, shape, or form, like Tracy and I talked about it, and this is what we're going to do. Again, what I was told and what I've been told from the start here is that Tracy had no idea what was going on. And so Mark Coyle coming out and saying that he and Tracy made this decision together to suspend these 10 players indefinitely, that's not the case. And why they're saying that that's the case, is one of the reasons why you see this football coaching staff speak out against their employer. And, again, it's just the disconnect. So even if Minnesota does get a new football coach, what is going to be repaired in this relationship between the athletic director, the revenue sports, the board of regents, the president? Where are they all going to finally get on the same page if there is a new head football coach here? I mean, Derek, call me crazy, but I just don't think that replacing the head football coach, obviously it'll do some things for PR in terms of, a new guy's in here now. But I mean, that same breath, this is, Jay Sovel and Tracy Clays and, Mike Sherrills. I mean, these are all guys that were here for this 31 win run, which is only the second time it's happened since 1905. But I mean, a new head football coach coming in, I mean, does that repair any of the problems that are evident in terms of this athletic department and the university?
Well, I think what you have to be careful of is, I'm not speculating on what's going to, just in general, you have to be careful when you replace the football coach. It usually comes with a lot of high expectations, excitement. I think it impacts ticket sales. So financials, it's a good thing in the short term. So it's easy to be caught up making these decisions, or if you're going to make a move on a head coach, because short term, it's we've talked about it before. It's kind of the backup quarterback syndrome, where the next guy, if the guy that's currently there isn't reaching all of the heights that you wanted him to, well, the next guy's for sure going to do it, because there's always the hope of the next person coming in. But I think what you're alluding to, Ryan, and what I would agree with is in this particular case, everybody needs to look at the administration and leadership on down and the structure that's in place, in addition to who the football coach is. It's easy. Who the football coach is and how they do and what they're going to change are very easy talking points. And for sure, it does have a gigantic impact. I don't want to minimize that. But I think your question is valid. I don't know that anybody has an answer for it right now. What if a change is made, what's going to change with the communication and or support or direction? We don't know. So I think that's a valid question, no matter what happens, whether Tracy Clays is given an extension or whether a change is made. I don't know that at least immediately any of those questions are going to be answered, but it should be something that people are thinking about.
Yeah, I think you bring up an interesting point. This is a team, now that had 9 wins. It came after a season where they really had 5 regular season wins, and they had a 6th, and they're one of the first teams to get a bowl bid with only 5 wins, and they found a 6th in that bowl game. But attendance was down. Like, that's a problem that Mark Coyle is going to have to overcome regardless, right? He had to find a way to get butts in seats, because that's important. That's what drives a big portion of your athletic revenue. The TV money helps significantly, but ticket sales are a drastic part of supporting an entire athletic department. The other thing, additionally, is athletic directors are notorious for wanting to have their guy, right? This is neither. So looking at all of athletics, especially in revenue sports, they want their guy. Richard Pitino is not Mark Coyle's guy. Tracy Clays is not Mark Coyle's guy. If he's going to take the heat for having a bad athletic department and the performance doesn't merit him keeping his $850,000 job, he'd rather, in speaking in kind of a broader sense, an athletic director would rather have that be their decision rather than their predecessors. And now he does make the decision to keep or get rid of coaches, but I can understand from his point of view wanting to get rid of Clays simply for that reason. And Ryan, we talked about this, you and I, off the record, that Clays was not a for sure thing given the structure of his salary and the fact there is a new athletic director, regardless of the scandal and the different things that happened throughout this season.
Yeah, I mean, you both bring up a lot of good points, and I think that the revenue aspect is absolutely something that this athletic department has to take into account. And again, I don't think it's anything Tracy Clays can do about it, but I do think attendance, if Tracy is here next year, is going to be down, even coming off a 9-1 season, something that hasn't happened a lot since 1905. There's a lot of other mouths to feed in this town with all the pro sports that Minneapolis, St. Paul area offers, and I think that the bottom line is going to come into account. And obviously, with the amount of of amount of revenue that revenue sports generate here at the university, and how the Board of Regents and the athletic director and just everybody involved there likes to spend it more or less in other places. I mean, obviously Minnesota does spend the fourth most amount of money in the Big Ten on their athletics. But again, if revenue is going to be down in terms of football revenue, that's going to impact other non-revenue sports, because there are only three sports at this university that make money. Men's hockey, I think, only makes like $400,000 or $500,000.
It doesn't make a lot of money, but yeah, it's basketball.
It's basketball, men's basketball, and football. And you bring up Richard Pitino, and we look in the same light. How does Richard Pitino survive? I mean, because he went through a sexual assault thing with Reggie Lynch. He's gone through the video thing with the players on the team, and he got an extension. And he's been through much more than Tracy has. So, I mean, I think we can – I mean, is it fair to ask in that same respect, why is Tracy being thrown under the bus, but Richard Pitino was able to get multiple extensions? I mean, how does that work? Any answer, Mr. Basketball?
No, I don't understand.
Exactly.
I don't understand.
And so the point being is I just want some kind of uniformity here. Like, I just want to know what I'm going to get each and every day from this athletic department, and I don't know that I'm going to get that because, I mean, you bring up bringing in your own guy if you're Mark Coyle. Well, Richard Pitino's not his guy.
Yeah.
And he's survived numerous sexual different things, you know, just different. I think there was an APR thing as well in terms of they dropped below 900 or something. And he's been able to get extensions, and the public is fine with it. But
Time heals a lot of things, right?
Yes, it does.
Time heals.
So in that same respect.
And winning also heals.
And he
a
hasn't
lot.
Won.
Well,
he won 8 games last year, and Tracy's coming off one of the most winning seasons in this football program in recent memory.
Yeah.
So again, you look at what the Richard Pitino is, and you look at the Tracy Clays thing, and what in the world? But I mean, I think there is a lot to be said in terms of the athletic director wanting to bring in his own guy. And again, the double-edged sword here, if you're Mark Coyle, is you know that they've won 31 games the last 4 years, one of the most winning periods in the last 50 years, consistently winning periods. And if you're going to bring in your own guy, you better make damn sure you're okay with, that he's going to continue to maintain the level of this program and then elevate it within a few years' time once he gets, you know, his air quote guys in here. And so with where I'm at with this whole coaching situation, and as I talked about it on Gopher Illustrated last night, is if you're looking for a day where you're looking for something to happen, I recommend don't leave TweetDeck unattended on Tuesday, because there's a lot of different things coming into play there. That most importantly is the day that Coyle and Clays are supposed to meet. And again, you look at the numerous statements that Coyle has released, because Mark Coyle is the king of releasing a statement, and it doesn't mean anything. It's just a bunch of words with no substance, and that's our $850,000 athletic director who's getting that from this president. But he has never once said publicly about an extension. You know, I said it in December because that was going to be the case. He was going to be extended barring this Title IX investigation, but obviously that blew a huge hole into everything. And I think for the first time since I've started looking into this, I've changed my course in the last 24, 48 hours. And I really wouldn't be surprised if Clays is let go on Tuesday. Again, I'm not necessarily saying that that's what I believe at this point in time, but for the first time since this entire thing has gone down since late November, I, for the first time, do believe there could be a change coming in the works. And if it does happen on Tuesday, what I would say is I expect if things do progress the way I'm hearing that they're progressing, is I think Wednesday would then be the next day, so the day afterwards, that Minnesota could have a new football coach. And again, we've talked about it on this podcast. We've talked about it at length here today, is how much does a new head football coach solve the problems that are here? Yes, it's probably going to get more butts in the seats. Yes, it's probably going to, you know, there's going to be a PR lift here. But once again, is it going to solve the lack of communication between the president, the athletic director, and the revenue sports head football and the head coaches here? I don't know that it'll do that. You know, is it going to solve the numerous other problems here in terms of trying to make sure that revenue sports are taken seriously? Because I think Derek mentioned it. You know, academia is very much an important thing for Eric Kaler. I think that, Luke, you were talking about that in the pre-production meeting was, you know, he was brought here to raise the level of academics at the University of Minnesota to a higher level, and I think he's done that. The question is that is going to remain is how seriously does Eric Kaler and this Board of Regents want to take revenue sports? Because I think it's clear that they really value the medical research and the medical things that they do here at this university. They really value the academics as a whole. But until they prove that they value revenue sports, because I can tell you from talking with people about the Board of Regents who know the Board of Regents, I can 100% say with certainty, not every single one of them value athletics as something that should be important at this university. And if that's not going to be the case, I don't know that you can consistently say that they're going to want to push revenue sports to the level of what Wisconsin really values the revenue sports as. Because I think it's, from what I've been told, you know, some on that Board of Regents really do value, you know, even non-revenue sports. You know, and that's great. I mean, if you want to have a great women's hockey team, a great volleyball team, a great baseball team, again, that's fine. But you also have to understand that they're going to lose money for this university each and every year, no matter how well they're doing. So if you don't want to feed the hand that does feed you in terms of football and basketball, that's where your problem is going to continue to come about at the end of the day. So, you know, if a new head football coach does come next week, you know, if Tracy is extended next week, I'm sure Luke and I will have a podcast either way. But I just don't know that a new football coach fixes the problems that are evident at this university. I mean, Luke, Derek, feel free to jump in. I feel like I've been rambling here. Derek, go ahead.
Well, yeah, the one thing I wanted to add that I think is I've had this form of this conversation with a few people, and I think there's a false notion here. You can have great academics at a university and great revenue sports. You can also have great revenue sports and great non-revenue sports. I think there's a false notion or a false dichotomy, if that's the correct term, that, well, we can either be great at academics here or we can be great at football. That's a false notion. If you look at the top revenue sports teams in terms of achievement, not monetarily necessarily, but well, it could be that too. But if you look at the teams that have won the most championships in revenue sports over the past, pick your time frame, I challenge you to tell me if any of them are bad academic institutions. Because
To your point, like if you want to look at next door to Wisconsin, I mean, I think they're a pretty good academic institution. You look at how successful their football and men's basketball programs have been, plus the high level of academia, it's attainable. I mean, don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
And the non-revenue sports at Wisconsin have been fantastic as well.
I know everyone probably listening to this podcast hates Wisconsin, you know, better dead than red and all that, but the example that they set in terms of, you know, you can have great revenue sports, you can have pretty good non-revenue sports, and you can be a high academia institution. The fact that, you know, if you are led to believe you can't have all three, you're being misled. And so, Luke, go ahead.
Oh, I don't really have a ton to add to that other than you're right. But Wisconsin made tough decisions. They cut sports.
And that's the other thing here is Minnesota, I believe, has 22 sports. I don't believe
I think Wisconsin has 13.
And that's where I'm going with this is, I mean, if you are not going to value revenue sports and say you keep Clay's, there's not going to be as many butts in the seats. And, you know, again, some of that is because of what Norwood did with the different donation increases, the different ticket increases, and some people got outpriced. But to that same respect, if you're going to keep 22 sports, and again, you look at Wisconsin only has 13, my point being, if there's not as many butts in the seats, you're going to have to start cutting these non-revenue sports because your revenue sports aren't going to be producing as much money. And yes, even with the media rights deals that this athletic department is bringing in because of the BTN and all the different things in terms of Fox buying some different rights from them and everything, you can't – I mean, Luke, I think you know what I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I think to add to your, you know, to the example, you know, if you want to look for a school very comparable to the University of Minnesota, an urban campus, a school that is in a town with a lot of pro sports and is academically very, very successful, you can look at Washington, who's going to play Alabama today, right? They're a school that is incredibly successful academically. Their revenue sports they've won a national championship in my lifetime. I'm only 29. They've been good. They've got a chance here now with under Chris Peterson. They've made a rise in football, but they're also very strong academically. Their basketball program struggled a little bit of late, but they've been very good. They've made Elite Eights and all that. Like, their revenue sports have been really good, and they have been academically successful in a pro sport market and in an urban setting. I mean, it's doable. It's not unattainable.
I think the common theme you should draw from each one of us today is that if you are being led to think that you can't have successful academics, you cannot have successful revenue sports and non-revenue sports, and you can't have all three, I think you're wrong. And I think we've laid out examples. We've let Luke just put out the perfect case for Washington. You know, Derek and I have talked about Wisconsin. And the point remains, folks, is until the Gopher higher-ups, you know, the Board of Regents, the president, and all the people that actually hold power at this university start to divulge and start to believe that, I don't know what changes in terms of this Gopher football program, in terms of trying to take it to the next level. Because, yes, the facilities are being built now to move them from the bottom. Because, in my opinion, revenue, practice, and day-to-day operation facilities in the Big Ten are at the bottom. Minnesota is 14th out of 14th right now. And yes, these new facilities are going to do wonders, but it just brings them into the middle of the Big Ten. And with the amount of other revenue sport programs being built, new facilities each year in the Big Ten, how long are they going to stay at number 7 out of 14 before they start to slide down to 9, 10, 11, 12 again? Because I think it'll happen within 5 to 7 years because of the facility arms races that's going on. And it shouldn't take 25 years again before game day, or not game day, because I think TCF Bank Stadium is a jewel. But in terms of day-to-day operations, practice operations, you can't have it another 25 years. And I just don't have the confidence that it will be that case. I mean, either one of you want to jump in, Luke?
No, I don't really have anything to add, Derek.
You know, the last thing I would say is kind of off the point we were talking about the coach. And the only thing I would urge people to do is, no matter who the coach is next year and the next 10 years, 20 years, in addition to all the things we scrutinize about the coach and the things we ask of that person and how are they going to win games, how is their recruiting class going to be and all those things, I would just encourage people to also ask a lot of the administration and the leadership of the university to support the revenue sports. And again, that doesn't mean not supporting academics. That doesn't mean not supporting non-revenue sports, but I'd like people to start looking at that and start maybe questioning and encouraging support above and beyond the football coach. And I think if we can shine a little bit of a light on that, I think it will only lead to better things, and at least people being more informed, and all of us, including everybody talking here today, being more informed, and we can know things and maybe take a broader look at things, because I think that's what's going to need to be necessary to take them to the next proverbial next step in football and basketball, is to look just beyond the coaches and look at how, as an institution, we can lay the foundation for success.
Yeah. So I don't think that there's too much else to say about today's podcast. So I think I'm going to wrap things up here. And as I said, if you're looking for a day to be on the lookout for what's going to happen with the head football coach at the University of Minnesota, be on the social media or be on Gopher Illustrated on Tuesday, because that is the day where I'm expecting something significant to happen.
Are you basically saying that everybody should be on their F5 key all day on Gopher Illustrated?
I am basically saying, if you want to know what's going on, I would continuously press your F5 key on GI from Tuesday to Wednesday. It's going to be hot and heavy, I guess, in terms of what I'm expecting. So with that being said, knowing that Tuesday and Wednesday is coming, I would look for an episode next week from Luke and I, and for Luke and I mean, we can't thank Derek enough. I mean, Derek, I think we're going to try to do something here in January, maybe do a live show and see if people want to come out and talk with us after, maybe have a couple questions during. But we can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast to break down each and every game that you could, because I mean, one of my favorite games to play was, instead of "Where in the World is Carmen Santiago," it's "Where in the World is Derek Burns?" So we thank you for coming on the podcast, and I know our listeners do as well.
Well, I appreciate it, guys, and I know we get into some heavy subjects, and there's you know, in addition to football, there's a lot of things to talk about, and I think you know, it should be talked about. But ultimately, I had a lot of fun, so I appreciate it. I love talking college football, and I'm a big fan of the sport. It's fun to be a fan of the sport now. There's a lot of great things about college football, so I appreciate the opportunity, guys.
All right, so it's been a fun season, some highs and some lows. But at the end of the day, it was fun to watch 9 wins. So thanks everybody for listening, and go Gophers.